This is jaysanalysis.com. I'm Jay Dyer. You're listening to my analysis of Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, the 1932 dystopia that in many ways is more accurate than George Orwell's 1984. The song you heard coming in was Kore Kosmu with Dream Agent, the excellent sultry tune from Aerial Electron. So check out their stuff if you like that song. One of my favorites, actually. Brave New World. Here we go. We're going to get hardcore. We're going to get deep. Stay with me. My copy includes an introduction, a foreword written by Huxley himself, discussing later his thoughts on the book after its publication. The first place to start in understanding this work is utilitarianism and the utilitarian happiness principle. Huxley is coming from a tradition, the British tradition of imperial empiricism. What is imperial empiricism? Well, from the time of the Enlightenment, the British version of it, we have a set of philosophers, namely John Locke, George Berkeley, Jeremy Bentham, many others who would roughly fit into this school of empiricism, and I should mention David Hume as well. The school of empiricism and utilitarianism. And utilitarianism is sort of the ethical corollary to empirical philosophy, which is an epistemic view, a view of epistemology that knowledge comes to us solely through sense experience and sense data. Naive empiricism is the perspective of scientism. Scientism will grow out of the British empiricist perspective. The economic, sometimes, and ethical position of utilitarianism is the happiness principle, the greatest good for the greatest number of people, supposedly. These are very flawed perspectives, but they flow from one another. So this is why so-called libertarian economics and economic theory flows out of this empiricist model of anthropology and human psychology. It's connected because it recast mankind following the late Middle Ages into a nominalist perspective. Out with the metaphysics, out with the universals, out with abstractions, and in with empirical science, data collection, numerics, quantification. That's the old system. The new system is scientism. That's what will develop out of this. So the revolutions are crucial to understanding Huxley's point and Huxley's thought. By these revolutions, he means the beginning of the scientific revolution, which led to economic revolutions, industrial revolution, the Enlightenment, etc., philosophical revolutions, political revolutions, communism, Marxism, socialism, etc., etc., French Revolution, and the final revolution, to use the terminology of the Fabians and Huxley and Bertrand Russell and the Royal Society social engineers, is the scientistic revolution. That is the final revolution. It is not a revolution to create freedom, as it was sold for many centuries. The false banner, the false epithet, the false sloganeering of freedom, greater freedom, democracy. That's not what the penultimate revolution is, as Huxley calls it. What is the final revolution? Well, it is that. It is scientism. It is the penultimate revolution that follows upon atomic warfare, the ability to supposedly create mass destruction. And all of this arises from scientific means that create the final power class of this immanentized eschaton, if you will. That is, at least the eschaton of the old world, the old way of doing things, old traditional cultures collapsing into the sci-tech revolution. That's the final revolution. The complete reorganization of man himself based on the principle of utilitarian happiness. That is the control mechanism. Why? Because it posits man only as a material actor in the world. Only as a material result of material determined processes. No higher faculties, no higher sense, no higher connection to metaphysics. Metaphysics no longer matters. All that matters is pragmatism. Pragmatism is the one school of philosophy that the United States has historically pioneered. And it is that connection to Bacon and scientism and the New Atlantis that America really fulfills in terms of a destiny. So the destiny of America is precisely a scientistic dictatorship. I don't say scientific because it's not really scientific. Now, that may sound controversial, but as we get to the end of Brave New World, you will see that that is exactly the fact. It is not a scientific revolution, ultimately, based on science. Science is used, but it's only used when it's useful for certain ends on the part of the technocrats. Science, in truth, is actually very dangerous, just like art. And that is precisely what we will see in Brave New World, and why it's not proper to call it science, but rather scientism, the abuse of the tools of discovering the natural world through such means. So that is Huxley's point in this foreword, is that Brave New World is a picture, a literary picture of the real revolution, the final penultimate revolution planned on the part of the social controllers, the social engineers, and the real power structure. Keeping in mind that this was written in 1932, the amount of foresight in terms of technological developments is really profound in this work. Some have claimed that Huxley actually ripped this off from a person by the name of Stanislav Mankowski, Mankiewicz. I forget the exact name of the I believe he's a Polish writer who wrote a dystopian film or a dystopian novel along the same lines. But that is a supposedly a debated topic in the history of literature. So whether or not that's true, I don't know. Some have claimed that, but regardless, it's still amazingly prophetic in what it foresees. What does it foresee? It foresees eugenics, a eugenics-based state that practices dysgenics. Everything will be classified and divided into a strict class system that goes from alphas to deltas. 70% of the female population are sterilized. Each segment of the population has a specific propaganda that's targeted towards it. Each of these Greek enumerated classes, alpha, beta, gamma, delta, epsilon. And it's a society that is drugged with soma, the hallucinogenic happy pill that everyone takes. It's also in a gas form. And it's not a repressive society in the sense of physical force. This is the point that differs from 1984. 1984 is very much a top-down socialist, fascist, communist, hardcore state where very brutal. The brutality of Brave New World is not found in physical force. The brutality is found in the sensuous pleasure of the world state. So there are hatcheries, and the hatcheries are where clones come. There originate. The hatcheries are where the population originates. No one is born from a womb anymore. In fact, it's bizarre, it's trite, it's laughable, it's comedic to talk about birthing natural. So from the alphas to the epsilons, this class structure is such that alphas have a lot more freedom and a lot more capabilities. Their genetics are modified such that they have the ability to do things that the epsilons are unable to do. The epsilons are essentially the stupidest of these classes. And everyone wears color-coded outfits, by the way, to signify which caste they are a member of. Mass production is applied to population production. And so population is something controlled scientifically insofar as producers or in the sense of factory work or in the sense of lab work are needed. So there's more or less a clone army, right? So something like Star Wars, right? Boba Fett's everywhere, the clone army. And there's a total quantification. Social predestination, pure and total quantification in a Rene Ganon sense, is absolutely applied across the board in totality in the world state predicted in the dystopian text of Brave New World. So the total control of reproduction is under the authority of this socialist world state. Everything is very sterile, including the population, for the most part. We will later find out that not every single person in the world state is actually sterilized, but we'll get to that in a bit. But it's important to see that even in the so-called perfect revolution, the lies of the older revolutions of egalitarianism don't apply. So there's no longer any pretense of there being castes and hierarchy. There are. And in the future dystopia, in this setting, no one objects to that caste system, that hierarchy, precisely because everyone has their place. And everyone has their place because they're happy. And this is what the world socialist dictator Mustafa Mond says in the novel. And what Huxley says in his famous Berkeley lecture is that the reason it's so appealing is that it creates a purely natural physical state of happiness, that is the drug soma. He even says in the lecture, were they actually to understand the circumstances and their slavery, why, they should be up in arms. Only a state of pure madness would accept such slavery. But of course, that's the very point, isn't it? There's something to that effect, right? That any normal person would see this setting as absolutely insane and madness. It's a society of madness. But when everyone has been drugged to the point that they will accept any situation as happy, right? You'll be happy in any station in life through Soma, then you've eliminated all possibility of revolution. So the irony here is that the domino effect of revolutions from the time of the Enlightenment and the Protestant Reformation and these various European revolutions sets in motion a long series of revolutions that end in the revolution to end revolutions. Total dictatorship. The end result of Robespierre, Danton, Lafayette, and the Marat, the French revolutionaries, is this very state, the social dictator state. So everything is a resource. Everything is tracked, traced, and controlled. Energy is a resource. And not just energy in the sense of fuel or whatever, but human energy is a resource. Humans are batteries, much in the sense of the Matrix, as we see in the popular film. Alphas are the intellectuals, as we said, all the way down to the epsilons, who are the lowest labor class. And Huxley says essentially that the epsilon class doesn't progress in mental maturity past what a 10-year-old is. So they're essentially 10-year-olds mentally who are test tube engineered. They're mass-produced humans that serve the function of doing the labor jobs. So divorce rampant sex, these are all effects that Huxley says in the foreword that he foresaw and essentially wrote those into the text. So mass divorce and rampant sexuality would be used as a means to control society. And again, this is 1932. So we're not talking about 1960s documents from the Pentagon. We're talking about Royal Society 1930s documents. That's what we have with Brave New World. And Huxley says very clearly, this is not fiction. It's a fictional portrayal of what is to come. The infant nurseries where everyone is created in a test tube and a culture dish. The babies are conditioned, we learn. There's Pavlovian, neo-Pavlovian conditioning at the decanting rooms and the infant nursery conditioning. The babies are electroshocked. So here we have sort of early nascent forms of mind control, MK Ultra, that would later be used with electroshock techniques, depatterning. This comes into play with infants in 1932 in Brave New World, amazingly. And what this does is this conditions them to accept the social order of Brave New World, the social order of the world controllers. The Pavlovian conditioning works because it's done like it's done with dogs, but on a mass scale with infants. And this does the work of creating and controlling instincts. And that's the point, is to reduce man, particularly the lower castes, to completely instinctual creatures, but not instinctual in the traditional sense of obeying biological drives and necessities. Sex, food, protection, self-defense. No, no, no. Eradicating all those, imprinting and patterning a new instinct, which is to simply follow rules, to simply obey the social order. Nature itself is in fact hated and is the enemy, because nature is seen as frail. And this is something we've highlighted many times in our analyses of the Hermetic view of the great work, which results in transhumanism. For Huxley, transhumanism, which is actually a term coined by the Huxleys, does play into this, because we have completely engineered humans. These are not normal, quote-unquote, humans, as we would traditionally think of them. These are test tube humans. These are clones. These are people who see sexual reproduction as gross, as disgusting, and as a joke. So very much, but that does not mean this is some sort of monastic, chaste society. No, rather, they actually have pedophilia, they have youth sex, they have rampant sexuality with anyone and everyone, more or less in your class, I suppose. But everyone is sterilized, and they take sterilants, if they're not sterilized, to ensure that you don't have natural reproduction. And that's the key here. And this is what we've seen now. This is essentially 2015. So we are in Brave New World now. We just haven't gotten fully into the standardization of the system that Huxley says will come. So state conditioning centers control birth, and that's what's key. And that's what we've seen proposed by the Rockefellers, by the Royal Society, by the Chinese government, by all of these different UN Population Councils, Pentagon. That is the goal here. The end of the family and total collectivism, right? That socialist, ultimately platonic republic model of human organization is where we're going. Everyone is brainwashed in this dystopia through sleep and what he calls hypnopedic engineering, hypnopedic conditioning. And this is a kind of mind control, MK Ultra-esque sleep technique where you are patterned according to these certain slogans as you sleep. You hear, you know, you listen to these tapes that repeat over and over, these mindless slogans of supporting the government. But again, it's also fascinating to note that the class consciousness has never been eradicated. So this is something supposedly from Marx, right, that Marx thought was going to end one day in the final revolution. That does not end, right? There's no end to the class system. There is rather the complete scientific regimentation of the class system. And that's the difference here. So everyone just chants mantras. They don't think through. In fact, it's discouraged to think through the mantras that the state gives you during your conditioning period, which is your youth, where you're basically under these mind control facilities for years. And that actually is the public education system that we have now. That child conditioning results in operant conditioning, which results in complete control in society. I should stop for a moment and discuss a little bit in relation to the origin of the name before we proceed on to chapter 3. The name Brave New World comes from The Tempest, and this is a section of The Tempest, Act 5, Scene 1, where we read, "Oh wonder, how many godly creatures are there? How beauteous mankind is! Oh, brave new world that has such people in it." Now, there's curious parallels and pre-signifiers, perhaps, of the new world in The Tempest. So, it's possible that Shakespeare knew about Magellan's circumnavigation, so he might have speculated about this new world in reference to the possibility of America. And it's these esoteric and hermetic Rosicrucian type images that appear in The Tempest that link it to Sir Francis Bacon's New Atlantis. So that this comes out of an esoteric magical tradition is what is most interesting. Because Prospero, the character, rules as a kind of artist king. He's the white magus. And he rules this island as an artist king. And the whole question of The Tempest largely surrounds fiction, fantasy, and reality. So very much what I was just discussing with Tim Kelly in our last interview over Esoteric Hollywood. There are tests by illusion. And this panopticism that comes into play with the island and the question of nature being harmonized with reason, Prospero's all-seeing gaze, these are elements that will, I think, in a way, esoterically pre-signify America, because America will be more or less the America and the UK, the Anglo-American establishment, will be Brave New World. That is Brave New World. That is the new Atlantis of Bacon. Not an Atlantis of utopia, but dystopia. And that's the end result of the scientistic scheme, because it's not true. It cannot build a utopia that translates into reality. It can only build a dystopia, as a bad philosophy thus translates into praxis, into reality. And that's where Brave New World comes in, because Brave New World is that very dystopia. It is the new Atlantis, but it's the new Atlantis that's a nightmare. So a little bit on that had to be said. And it's this atmosphere of the long-standing British occult tradition, all the way back to figures like John Dee and the Elizabethan court astrologers and magi, Bacon, these different esotericists, the Ben Jonson, the John Duns, their fascinations with alchemy, Edmund Spencer's Fairy Queen, full of all this same alchemy, Rosicrucian, and esoteric symbology, which I have two or three graduate papers that I've written on that topic. That is the background to Brave New World. And so what I think we see is, because there's a lot of truth in those Hermetic traditions as it relates to secret principles in nature. And so what happens over time is that as the scientific process filters out the fiction from the fact, in that process, the study of nature, alchemy, what happens is that the metaphysics gets dropped, and the resulting dystopia is precisely a result of that dropping of metaphysics, because it's the final revolution into a completely controlled, materialistic, atheistic state. Parallels could be seen in something like the Soviet Union, where you have a completely atheistic state. Fabianism, Fabian socialism, is essentially what is in Brave New World. This is the Fabian state. So children are sexualized. Children are named after various revolutionaries, Bernard Marx, Polly Trotsky, etc. But there's also the blending of capitalism, because, as we know, they speak in terms of the year of our Ford instead of the year of our Lord. And at the quasi-Masonic, non-denominational, pseudo-religious service that everyone participates in, they have a large Model T that is the new form of the cross instead of the T, the Tau of Christianity. The new cross is the T in terms of the Model T Ford. So there's a homage to industrial capitalism as well as homage to Marxism. And this is a revelation from Huxley, a member of this Royal Society itself, behind both of these revolutions, the capitalism and the communism, demonstrating that both of these are controlled. They're two arms of the same dialectic, capitalism versus communism. And that's what Huxley's telling you. They're two roads that lead to the same destination. And that's why the future Fabian state honors both. There's no religion. There's no history. You don't read Shakespeare. You don't read the past. That's all forbidden, forgotten, taboo. And people don't want to read it anyway. History is bunk, is one of the phrases. Films and movies are completely sensory based. They have no depth. They have no meaning. They're called feelies. They're very sexual in nature, more or less softcore porn with action and sensory stimuli and overload. That's it. That's the feelies. The theaters. Music is synthetic. It's essentially techno. I'm not dissing techno. I like electronic music quite a bit. But we get the impression that this techno is just merely a computer program. No human creation involved. It's all just pumped out of speakers via computers. That's it. Our Ford, our Freud. Everyone belongs to everyone else. Love is something laughable, something preposterous in this dystopia, because everyone belongs to everyone else. Love implies possession. That is mine, not yours. Right? That's my wife. That's my husband. That's my child. That cannot exist in a society where everyone belongs to everyone else, the supposed collective. There's no emotions because everyone is drugged. The signifying of emotions suggests, the conveying of emotions suggests instability. And this is a society based on stability, not through brute force, but through happiness, through the pleasure principle. Water is controlled and drugged. The Russian technique for infecting water supplies was particularly ingenious, as it is said on page 48. Sterilants in the water, fluoride in the water, a reality we see today. Rule by brains and buttocks. Government's an affair of sitting, not hitting. You rule with the brains and the butt, never the fists. So, in other words, you outsmart and you use bodily desires and sexuality to control the masses. You don't control the masses through 1984. Consume, consume, consume. So it's very much a consumer society. This is not an anti-consumer society. Another difference from 1984, Eric Blair, George Orwell. This is cloning and Fabianism. Humans are a marketable, consumable commodity, a product. They come out of test tubes. They're like McDonald's creations. Big Mac people, right? Aspartame ideologies. Natural birth, again, as I said, is laughed at. There are campaigns against the past. Museums do not exist. There are no books beyond the last 150 years. So again, this is a significant amount of years into the future. So in other words, 150 years is still future to us in terms of when this dystopia is taking place. Everyone is euphoric, narcotic, and pleasantly hallucinant. You have Ford's Day instead of the Lord's Day. The sacrament is drugs, and the Feely ritual ceremony that you have at your quasi-Masonic inter-denominational pan-religious ceremony that worships the great architect. And what's fascinating, as I mentioned too, is that everyone thinks in their own caste that they're kind of elite, right? Their caste is special. And that's the programming and the social engineering targeted specifically for each caste. So people will say things like, well, I'm glad I'm not a gamma. You know, I'm a delta. There's a fake equality that's pushed, even though there's a caste system where obviously people aren't equal. There's a bureau of propaganda. There's a college of emotional engineering. It's basically like living on a state university campus is a good way to put it. What's Brave New World like? Imagine living your whole life on a state university campus. TV is psychological warfare. That's even mentioned. It's a psyop. The feeling picture, not just the moving picture, the feely picture. All created by the propaganda house of emotional engineering. Feely fake TV. News is read by sexy babes, sexy voices, info babes. The soul is stamped out, as Brave New, as Bertrand Russell said would happen. The soul would have to be stamped out. This is the Bertrand Russell system, Bertrand Russell structure. There are mass crematoriums for death, in the sense of, if you've seen Logan's Run, this is portrayed well in that film where everyone participates in euthanasia because it's an honor to be cremated at the state crematorium. And they have a nice little ceremony and some pretty elevator music, and you just drift away as you are shoved into the incinerator. And you are used as fertilizer. So you still serve your function to be a human commodity. You become fertilizer for the plants in the beautiful, happy dystopia. And everyone's happy. As said many times, everyone's happy. Everyone takes drug holidays. Your holidays, so-called, are drug holidays. And everyone listens to drug music. And everyone takes their pills, not just their soma, but also their birth control pills. If they're not a member of the sterilized class, then you take what's called your Malthusian pills. And so that's, again, Thomas Malthus, one of the early progenitors of eugenics, the idea of controlling the population, all put in place in the Brave New World dystopia. The Rothschilds are mentioned. One of the important people is Morgana Rothschild. So all throughout, Huxley's, through these names, giving you clues, Ford, Rothschild, Marx, Trotsky, etc., as to who the important movers and shakers in global change have been. The service, as I said, the fake church service, the Logan's Run death cult, worships the greater being, the no-content, abstract, impersonal being. Not a god, a being. Generic unity is what's worshipped. The liturgy of the fake church, fake state, is called the Orgy Porgy. The dancers get caught up in the liturgical refrain of the Orgy Porgy. Orgy Porgy, Ford and Fun, kiss the girls and make them one. Boys at one with girls at peace, Orgy Porgy gives release. This is your liturgy. So, everything is conveyed here, and that's what I want to convey to the listening audience, is that everything of the totality of the plan in real world is conveyed in totality in the novel, Brave New World, in 1932. Everyone's named after a Marxist and an industrialist, and that is crucial. Everyone is entertained by the most ridiculous, base, low, common, vulgar entertainment. Idiocracy. But it's not total idiocracy in the sense of the satire film, because there's a caste system where you still have intelligent people. The alphas in Brave New World are the smartest of the brainwashed classes. And they are, in fact, very brainwashed. That's very important. So in our day, the CEOs, the sports figures, the so-called alphas of whatever spectrum or aspect of life we're speaking of, they don't really know, most of the time, the real game plan. They are propagandized. So you don't have feelings, but you do go to feelies. So feelings would suggest social concern, interpersonal concern. That's not allowed, not desired. Feelies are purely sensuous, orgasmic, fleshly, licentious, trigger response. Bodily reaction, right? So that, for example, the sexuality in Brave New World is never attached to any emotion. It's just purely a biological action of pleasure. That's it. I'm not going to go too deep into all the characters, but I will a little bit. So you have Lenina, Bernard Marx, John the Savage, Mustafa Mond. These are the main characters. And Bernard is a somewhat questioning but manipulative guy who's interested in getting ahead. But John the Savage lives on a reservation. So what we've come to find out is that there's a reservation of people who still live the old way. There's a whole society, and sometimes the alphas from London in the world state, the socialist world state, will for a whim, for fancy, will visit the island where the savages are, the specific area where they keep the specimens of the old culture. And the Savage Reservation, excuse me, it's not an island, it's in New Mexico. And that we learn that these people are the descendants of the Anasazi, which were a mysterious tribe that disappeared at one time. Where they went, who knows? But they're the famously disappearing tribe. Why Huxley has chosen that, I'm not sure. That would be interesting to try to research. But John the Savage is a member of this group. And we come to find out that he still participates in the religious ceremonies of his tribe. So he's kind of a syncretistic, natural religion, animism, mixed with a little bit of Christianity, because he believes in Jesus, but also these other spirits. So he's a representation of the old world, really, is what John is, John the Savage. And the reservation is kept like a zoo. And the people in the reservation are viewed like animals. They're zoo animals, relics of an older time, that serve a scientific purpose for the socialist world state. And the Malpai reservation is very dirty. So it has this messy, this earthy, bloody, stinky humanness to it that is in stark contrast to the sterile, dead, white, barren, technocratic state of London. And when Lenina visits, the girl interest in the film, she begins to have an affinity for John the Savage. And they decide that they want to, excuse me, take John the Savage to London, because he's an interesting character. And he'll be kind of a thing of gossip, a party favor of sorts amongst the London elite, amongst the alphas, being this older relic of a character from the reservation. So they bring John to London, to the world state, and John is shocked. So he goes through a period of culture shock. He doesn't understand the total collectivism. He doesn't understand the symbolism, the imagery, the barrenness, the drugs, even though in his culture they still had drugs too. So that's a fascinating parallel that still carries over. Drugs never go away. In fact, they become crucial. And the hypocrisy we discover is that the world, one of 10 world socialist directors, world social controllers, Mustafa Mond, is actually John's dad. So Mustafa Mond has an affinity for the ancient world, as we learn of his hypocrisy, being the atheist world dictator, because he impregnated John's mom. And Bernard is found out to be a selfish pragmatist. What we are left with is John the Savage, who's going to function as a kind of revolutionary in London against this brave new world technocratic state. And Lenina, his love interest, the alpha level female who begins to develop a sexual attraction for John the Savage that goes beyond mere play. She actually begins to have an attachment for him. They will be set against Mustafa Mond, the world controller, whose hypocrisy becomes evident, and who ultimately they will have a showdown with. And that's the most revealing aspect of the story that we'll get to in a moment. But so John is in the midst of all this. He doesn't understand the feelies. He's troubled by the religious ceremonies. He's, as I said, culture shock. There's only one mention of a bank in the whole book, which is fascinating. The Bank of England is the only thing that's mentioned. Excuse me, the Bank of Europe, excuse me. So we don't see much economics in this book because, of course, economics presupposes individual action for the purpose of profit, gain, monetary exchange, and so forth, which isn't really needed in this world. So banking doesn't actually play much of a role in the future dystopia. But John, while on the reservation, read a lot of Shakespeare. So he's constantly quoting Shakespeare. He's remembering things from the Bible, his religious traditions, and he's mentioning these things, and no one in the enlightened tech dystopia knows what he's talking about. They laugh at him. They think it's funny. It's idiocracy on one level, even though they're very scientifically learned. They have no idea what Shakespeare is. They don't know what he's talking about. One of the most important sections in the book, there's two. The first is Mustafa Mond's reflection as he's deciding which texts will be published in Science. This is crucial. So the top of the chain in London is deciding which texts will be published in science journals. Does this sound familiar? It sounds just like what The Lancet said a few months ago, that half of the world's literature in terms of scientific data is false. Why, that sounds just like Brave New World and Mustafa Mond now, doesn't it? A New Theory of Biology was the title of the paper which Mustafa Mond had just finished reading. He sat for some time meditatively frowning and then picked up his pen and wrote on the title page, "The author's mathematical treatment of the conception of purpose, telos, is novel and highly ingenious, but heretical. And so, for the present social order, as it is concerned, it is dangerous and potentially subversive, and therefore, quote, not to be published." He underlined those words. The author will be kept under supervision. His transference to the Marine Biological Station of St. Helena may become necessary. A pity, he thought, as he signed the name. It was a masterly piece of work. But once you begin admitting explanations in terms of purpose, well, you didn't know what the result might be. It was the sort of idea that might easily decondition the more unsettled mind amongst the higher castes to make them lose their faith in happiness as the sovereign good, and to take to believing instead that the goal was somewhere beyond, out there, somewhere outside the present human sphere, that the purpose of life was not the maintenance of well-being, but some intensification and refining of consciousness, some enlargement of knowledge, which was, the controller reflected, quite possibly true, but not, in the present circumstance, admissible. He picked up his pen again, and under the words, "not to be published," drew a second line, thicker and blacker than the first, and then sighed. What fun it would be, he thought, if one didn't have to think about happiness. Quite a bit packed into that. How often do I critique scientism and the ruse that everyone is under, that we live in this scientific society with Bill Nye and Neil deGrasse Tyson and Hitchens and Dawkins spouting out this great era of evolution and science? And yet, in 1932, Huxley was telling you that science is strictly controlled as much as any other area of full spectrum dominance. The purview of full spectrum dominance includes everything from science to the arts to education to government, you name it. And this is what he's telling you. This is admitted right here, and it's going to be even clearer in section two. And I'd like to point out as well that I've mentioned many times before revisiting Brave New World that telos is what had to be destroyed in nature and in scientific inquiry. Because if there's telos out there in nature, that suggests that there's purpose, that there's a higher metaphysical objective principle that we are thus bound to. That means the state and the world state and the world corporate state don't have complete dominance and control over all reality. Right? Because there are metaphysical principles, truth, God, etc., beyond them. It means that they're not God. And so you can't have competing authority structures and competing principles out there in the world, such as metaphysics or whatever, that limits your power if you're a state that seeks complete and total power. So, as John has this breakdown and tries to start a revolution, he speaks to a crowd of people in the dystopic city of London. And he asks, "Do you not have any sense of the poetic or of the aesthetic? Everything is literal." And yes, everything is literal. They've lost all sense of imagination, creativity, right brain intuitiveness. That's all gone out the window because we're living under the imperial, empiricist, pragmatist state, which of necessity excludes, negates, and excommunicates right brain creativity, because that's out of the purview of control once again. It suggests individual inspiration on the part of the artist. That also must be controlled. That's the two things that Mustafa Mann will say are the most dangerous to the state: science and art. There you go. So Linda gets cremated. That's John's mom. They just throw her into the crematorium. John is upset. He cries. But they have instead, for everyone else who's not upset at the deaths that are constantly happening in the crematoriums, they have death education. Yes, death education, which we learned about after Columbine and that staged event, that PSYOP. Huxley said we would have death education in 1932. So you want to understand what are these school shootings really about? What are these traumatizing events? It's death education. What's death education about? Brave New World. There's no funeral, no service. You just get roasted. Right? You just get incinerated. You're just human hot pocket, and then you become fertilizer. Mourning death, anyone who would mourn death, is actually mocked. And so that's why John has his breakdown in the crematorium, is because he's upset that no one cares about death. That he can't mourn his mom's death. They bring in a troop of kids who are studying death, and they're all kind of standing around laughing and wondering why John's crying. And that, John basically has a meltdown. Because, and this is another interesting point, everyone is, in one sense, scientifically sophisticated. If just presuming that you're in the upper classes here of the alphas and the betas. But they are babies. They're not men, and they're not women. They're childlike. And that is what John says when he tries to rebuke the crowd following his mother's death. He says, "Do you like being slaves?" the savage said as they entered the hospital. His face was flushed, his eyes bright, and his ardor in it, with ardor and indignation. "Do you like being babies?" "Yes, babies, mewling and puking," he said, exasperated by their bestial stupidity, and throwing insults at those who he had come to save. The insults bounced off the carapace of thick stupidity. They stared at him with blank expressions full of dull, sullen resentment. "Yes, you're puking babies, absorbed into an..." absorbed into an intense, overpowering hatred for these monsters. John begins to see what's going on here. So this is imagery borrowed from Plato's Allegory of the Cave, where John becomes the figure like Socrates, who gives this analogy, who tries to enlighten the people in the dystopia about their bondage and slavery. And in the Berkeley lecture, Huxley says as much. He says, "You're slaves. What? How are you liking this insanity that you're in?" So that's total double mind, total revelation of the method there on the part of Huxley, who was very much involved in helping create this Fabian technocratic society. Huxley says to you who believe in this society and who follow it, you're insane to actually like this slavery. Yet that's the great paradox, isn't it? That's the great mystery here. And this is, this poignant scene is what exemplifies that, with John trying to wake these people up, so to speak. He's speaking to a crowd of deltas who are the next level up from the bottom of the stupidest people. He's speaking to 10-year-olds, basically, trying to get them to understand, 10-year-old adults, trying to get them to understand that they are dupes. And if you've ever talked to baby boomers, if you've ever talked to the general public, this is the experience that you have. You try to explain to them the situation, that all of the reality that you move and operate in is slavery. It's a lie. And the response that you get from those who are supposed to be adults is they act like children, right? They get mad at you. They immediately act like spoiled brats. And that's what happens with John here. That's what they do to John. And so they bring in a bunch of spraying. They aerosol spray the crowd. So it's kind of a chemtrail type thing where they spray everybody with their soma, their happy pill. And that puts them into a happy state. And then the voice comes on, which everywhere in the dystopia is the voice. And the voice is this soothing voice, that the NPR voice. Why are you happy? Why aren't you happy? Why are you sad? There's no need to be sad. Enjoy your life. Right? All that comes on. Oh, how I want you to be happy. If you think of THX-1138, where Robert Duvall is confessing his sins to the robot confessional, and there's that cheese ball robot Jesus that says, blessings of the state, blessings of the masses. Right? And then Robert Duvall confesses his sins to a robot. That's what we, the same imagery here, the voice. I do want you to be happy. So, you know, expect that in the future. You'll have DARPA robots walking around the streets, and if anybody gets unhappy, the robots will comfort you and give you back massages and tell you that they love you and want you to be happy, and spray you in the face with a bunch of Prozac. So then we come to the climactic scene of being ushered before Mustafa Mond to haggle with him and argue over society. John's mad. He just tried to spark revolution. Didn't work. All the people tried to kill him for telling him the truth. And Mustafa Mond brings him in, and they have this really profound talk that is the most enlightening and important section in the book. And first, John starts talking about Shakespeare, and Mustafa Mond is the first person in the world society he's met who knows who Shakespeare is. So John quotes Shakespeare, and Mustafa Mond actually knows what he's talking about. So that blows John away. And Mustafa Mond says, well, I make the laws here so I can also break them. I'm not bound by these laws that all the idiots are bound by. So, yeah, of course I've read Shakespeare. I've got a safe where I've got the Bible, a bunch of literature, Othello, Romeo and Juliet, you know, all the classics. So John can't understand this. He says, Well, why don't you tell everybody else about this? He says, they don't want that. Why would the rest of these brainwashed, mind-controlled slaves, why would they want to leave their servitude? They love their servitude, and they've chosen their servitude. So why would I share with them a bunch of literature that's difficult, that they would have to wrestle with, grapple with, chew upon, in a classical pedagogical sense? Why would I share that with them? Pearls before swine. They don't want this. So John's kind of blown away by that. And he says, well, what about high art? You don't even have any high art here in your so-called utopia, your dystopia. Mustafa Mond says, why would I have high art? These idiots don't care anything about high art. They like the dumb shit, right? They like feelies. They like Action Jackson. They're not going to care about Titian, Rembrandt. They're not going to care for Bernini. Why would... That doesn't make any sense. So John has this older view of human nature that's very lofty, because he's part of that older world where these things would be appreciated. Mustafa Mond, his foil, is the complete embodiment of the new world order, of scientism, of technocratic control, devoid of beauty, aesthetics, arts, creativity, and true science. So this contrast, this juxtaposition between these two characters is the best part of the book, and this is the most revealing. And Mustafa Mond explains, "Our world, you see, is not the same as Othello's world. You can't make flivvers without steel, and you can't make tragedies without social instability. The world is stable now. People are happy. They get what they want. They never want anything that they can't get. They're well off. They're safe. They're never ill. They're not afraid of death. They're blissfully ignorant of passion, love, old age. They're plagued with no mothers or fathers, no family struggles, no wives, no kids, no lovers to feel strongly about. They're so conditioned that they practically can't help behaving but as they ought to behave. And if anything should go wrong, well, then there's Soma, which you go and chuck out of the window in the name of so-called liberty. Savage liberty? Expecting a delta to know what liberty is. And now expecting them to read Othello? My good boy." The savage was silent for a moment. "All the same," he said, "Othello is good. Othello is better than all those stupid feelies." "Of course it is," Mustafa Mond agreed. "That's the price, though, that we have to pay for stability. You got to choose between happiness and what used to be called high art." "The feelies are just emotional engineering," he says. So this society is a pyramid, and that's what Mustafa Mond says. They even tried, this is a point that John says, "Well, why don't you, if you can create the people that you want, why don't you just create a whole society of alphas?" And Mustafa Mond says, "Well, we did that. We did that back in 473 AF, that is, after Ford. The island of Cyprus back in 473 AF was a completely controlled social experiment where everyone was an alpha. We put 22,000 alphas there, and unfortunately the alphas were smart enough to figure out that they were in a controlled society, and they rebelled." He said, so the whole island was a big disaster, and so a society built on levels of castes in a pyramid is much more stable than a society of alphas. "The optimum population," Mustafa Mond said, "is modeled on the iceberg, 8/9 below the water line and 1/9 above it," which is a pyramid. Right. There you go. He said, the reason it didn't work, by the way, is because you had some alphas that were having to do epsilon moron work, and they went crazy and started smashing things up. So when you put epsilons into, when you put alphas into epsilon work, which was what was required for this social experiment on the island of Cyprus, it ended in a big disaster. So John is mystified, and he still can't understand this completely different world that he's in, and he says, well, what about science, though? And John is actually there with a few other people from London, from the dystopia, who got in trouble for being present at his attempted revolution. And they also inquire about science. They want to ask Mustafa, because they can't believe Mustafa Mond's hypocrisy. How can you be reading Shakespeare and you've impregnated a woman in a natural way, and all of this hypocrisy? You like high art? What? While at the same time, you're sitting here telling us that we live under a scientific dictatorship and that is the perfect society. So you're lying. It's hypocrisy. And essentially, Mustafa Mond is saying, yeah, of course it is. I'm not subject to those rules because those rules apply for the retards. That's for all the idiots and all of you that bought into this. Now, this is the key page that I'm going to have to read because we're going to learn what science really is. In our day, science, scientism, is perfectly explained and exposed here in a total revelation of the method way by Huxley. And I want everyone to really get this down, really, 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 really remember this and learn this, because I've had so many arguments, so many debates with people over this point who just can't fathom that Dawkins, Hitchens, academia, the scientific establishment could be controlled, and they are. And that's what you have to understand. And that's what I'm going to show you that Huxley was saying back in 1932. So, coming to the conclusion page here, we see that the Hermetic course is what led to scientism in the West. And society becomes completely weaponized for the purpose of stability according to the utilitarian happiness principle. And the conclusion is precisely that science is dangerous. Real science. That's Mustafa Mann's point to the savage. There's another reason that we're so chary of applying new inventions. Every discovery in pure science is potentially subversive. Even science must sometimes be treated as a possible enemy. Yes, science. Science, the savage frowned. He knew the word, but what exactly it signified he could not say. Shakespeare and the old men of the Pueblo had never mentioned science, and from Linda he had only gathered the vaguest hints. Science was something that you made helicopters with, something that you made that caused you to laugh at the corn dance. It was something that prevented you from being wrinkled and losing your teeth. He made a desperate effort to take the controller's meaning. Yes, Mustafa Mond was saying. That's another item in the cost of stability. It's not only art that's incompatible with happiness, it's also science. Science is dangerous. We have to keep it most carefully chained and muzzled. What? Said Helmholtz in astonishment. But we're always saying that science is everything. It's a hypnopedic platitude. 3 times a week between 13 and 17, said Bernard, and all the science propaganda that we did at college. Yes, but what sort of science? Asked Mustafa Mond sarcastically. You've had no scientific training, so you can't judge. I was a pretty good physicist in my day. Too good. Good enough to realize that all our science is just a cookery book with an orthodox theory of cooking that nobody's allowed to question, and a list of recipes that mustn't be added to except by special permission from the head cook. I'm the head cook now. But I was an inquisitive young scientist once. I started doing a bit of cooking on my own, unorthodox cooking, illicit, a bit of real science, and that got me in trouble. There you go. So, as a result, discussion is made in regard to what to do with John and the other revolutionaries that discover Mustafa Mond is a fraud, to send them off to the island. And in this setting, the island is where actual artists and people who figure out that the society is bullshit are sent. And John, there's some discussion of sending John there, but they decide no. John tries to kind of run away, and he goes and sets up in the final chapter of the novel his own little hermit scenario, living in an old lighthouse. And he's gardening and doing his own, cooking his own food. And years later, reporters come, sort of tabloidy people and TV gab gossip types come looking for the savage, and they eventually find John living out in this old lighthouse, and they surround him with constant television, camera, media spectacle. John becomes a spectacle, and as a result of this, he hangs himself. So the climax of the novel is John hanging himself, and this represents the death of the old world in total. Of course, the reservation is still there, but John was that last sort of potentiality for revolution against the final revolution. And that's what we have with Brave New World. That's the entirety of this message, is complete scientistic control, panopticon, revolution to where there's no more revolution. Right? The snake ends up eating its own tail. The Ouroboros of the revolutionary move ends in a total tyranny. But, as Mustafa Mann says, a tyranny of necessity. A tyranny where it's a tyranny of actually the acceptance on the part of the masses of the lies. It's the masses that put themselves into this tyranny because they don't want truth, and they don't want a society that involves itself in the potential for unhappiness. So the flight from struggle, from adversity, what makes men into men, the flight into the Kali Yuga, the aeon of the child, of immaturity, of lies, deception, that is the society that breeds its own tyranny, the society that creates its own tyranny. So on one level, yes, it is Mustafa Mond and the world socialist controllers that are guilty, and they're frauds, but on the other hand, it's society too that's guilty, and it's a fraud, because they share in this guilt of not loving what's true. And because they don't love what's true, and they prefer and love lies, they become their own worst enemy. And that's the message of Brave New World. It's also the message of where we live today. So it's not always the oligarchs that are to blame. They do share a good bit of the blame, because they are the social controllers that helped engineer and get us to this point of Brave New World. But it's also the lies that men prefer to believe to avoid culpability. And it's that avoidance of culpability and responsibility, and the responsibility for knowing truth and loving and figuring out truth, that is the cause of their own enslavement. And that's what point Huxley makes in the Berkeley lecture. So this is Jay's analysis of Brave New World. There you have it. That is what I got from the text, revisiting it this year, 2015. A lot of stuff that I never would have seen back when I read it, you know, in my younger days, in my 18, 19-ish period. And there's just so much there. It's very prophetic. It's very, in ways, esoteric. It's revelatory of what's really going on. But I would like to stress that it proves my point about hidden metaphysics, which I've discussed many times in talks and articles. Real science, true science, is something that I really like. And just because I study philosophy doesn't mean that I didn't love philosophy of science, and that I don't care about the natural world as a manifestation of God's divine logos. The logoi in the material world are the very things that demonstrate God's omniscience, his telos, etc., his providence. But that has been removed by the ideology of the Royal Society, and so it speaks to the claims of Kurt Gödel that there was a great conspiracy to make men dumb, as he discovered from Bertrand Russell, whom he debated. There was a conspiracy to suppress metaphysics, as Kurt Gödel claimed, in response to Russell and the Fabian Society. And there was a conspiracy to stamp out the soul and to erect a materialistic, determined technocracy. as Bertrand Russell and the Huxleys and the Fabians and the Royal Society have all professed. So this is your world. This is the real world, and this is where we live. We live right now at the cusp of Brave New World. I mean, it's here in a sense, and it's really going to be here in the next 10 or 20 years. I mean, really. And this is where we are. So here you are in Brave New World. And I think if you're listening to this, you, like me, are more on the side of John the Savage. And ironically, John the Savage had much in common with Mustafa Mond, the world socialist controller, because they both loved what was true. They loved true art, high art, good art, aesthetics, in a real sense. They weren't duped. But John was honest and sincere in what he wanted. Mustafa Mond was a pragmatist and had no ideals, even though he believed that metaphysics was true and that there was a God and that science really did discover things that pointed in that direction. But all that had to be suppressed, and lies had to be engaged in, large scale lies and psyops and deceptions, right there in Brave New World. What is Brave New World? The psyop state. Large scale mass media deception. Mass drugging. Big pharma. Mass MK Ultra. That is Brave New World. And Brave New World, even it's all the very techniques that you read in the MK Ultra leaks, insofar as we understand what's in those leaks. So that proves to me MK Ultra is real, because it's in Brave New World prior to the release of any MK Ultra documents, and it's what we see in the social order today. It's Big Pharma. That's MK Ultra right there. So you want proof that MK Ultra is real? Brave New World. There you go. Exact same. So this has been Jay's analysis. This has been Brave New World. I hope you enjoyed this. I think that it was a useful detour break from Plato's Republic, but we will return to that. So I want to thank listeners and tell your friends about jaysanalysis.com. There will be much more to come in the future in terms of literature, philosophy, film, geopolitics, esoterica, history, you name it.